Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that takes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Nora Snapes.
And I'm Fraser McAlpine.
And on this week's agenda, we have new social media. There is baby news from a listener. Plus, we fixed the charts. How are you, Fraser?
I'm really well. I think there's an air of anticipation to anybody that's listening to this particular podcast because it's the first since the charts have been rejigged in order to deal with what we called the Sheeran singularity 16 weeks ago. So we'll not get into it straight away, but you know, your patience will be rewarded. Thanks to everyone that tweeted.
I mean, I hope our wisdom will be recorded. I'm waiting for a check from Official Charts in the post. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure it must be on the way.
Oh yeah, definitely. Some kind of consultation fee. It'll be in the astronomical figures.
Thank you to everybody who has been subscribing and leaving us reviews on iTunes. It's really, really helpful. And we have also been on the front page of the iTunes podcast thing this week in their summary podcast zone, which has brought in lots of new listeners. So hello to you if this is your first time, and thank you. We have, 17 weeks late, you might say, started a Facebook page finally, which is facebook.com/unbreakmychart. We promise not to spam your pages. We'll be very sparing with updates, but new episodes will be posted on there, as well as odd bits of chat and discussion and anything that we might want your views on. So do like that if you fancy that kind of thing.
And of course, if you want to raise a land army against us, then that's the place to do it, and it will go the way of all forums. And in about a year's time, you'll all be saying to each other, it's not as good as it used to be. I liked it when it was originally better. Some newbies will come in and they'll say, hey, I'm here to talk about Unbreak My Chart, and then all of you lot who are already there will kill them and shout at them and make me feel really unwelcome, because that's how forums work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have also been the forum master of some particularly, or some unexpectedly vicious forums.
Yeah, I've done across the BBC. I won't name names, but yes, some people who've been listening to or enjoying television programmes of some vintage, when they join the forums for those programmes and they stay there for a while, they become enormously entrenched in their communities and really resistant to just about any point of view that isn't their own, including that of the people that make the programme.
Well, as it stands, you can post onto the Unbreak My Chart Facebook page, and we hope that it will be a harmonious zone. But yeah, obviously, feel free to disagree and post whatever you fancy on there, any songs you want us to listen to. If you were listening to last week, that was our Songs of the Summer episode, which we did a few weeks after we started asking for your Songs of the Summer. We had a very nice update from Henry Barnes, who I think sent this to you, Fraser, who sent one of the suggestions in.
Yes, that's right. He had said when he nominated his favourite Paramore song that his wife was about to give birth the next day. And I said in last week's podcast, well, we didn't know what happened and I hope everything was all right. Well, he tweeted just to say, top 10 and mum both doing well. Me equals more tired, less depressed. So he's in a better frame of mind now that his second child has been born. And obviously we wish you all the very best, Henry. Thanks for letting us know that all is well.
Result all round.
So, after mentioning in episode one that it would be nice to restrict new albums to nominating singles for consideration in the top 40 singles charts and just sticking to this is the single, this is all you have to worry about whenever a new album comes out. And John sort of reiterated that a couple of weeks ago when he stood in for Laura and added that the chart should consider restricting the amount of time that songs could dominate the charts for. The Official Charts company officially announced this week that they're changing the way the charts are being compiled. The new rules state that there's two things in the new rules, and it's brilliant because they're both things that we suggested. Number one, only the three most popular tracks by any artist will be allowed in the top 100. And number two, there's going to be a new streaming ratio for older tracks so that the longer they've been in the charts, the faster they fall out of the top 100. Currently, the stats are tallied from physical sales, digital sales, and streaming, and it's 150 plays equals on any streaming platform that is chart eligible, it equals one sale. After a song has been in the charts for a number of weeks under the new system, and this is the weird thing because I can't find anywhere where it says how long that's going to be, but once the single starts to plummet from the charts, the ratio changes now to 300 plays equals one sale. which is certainly good news for us because it makes us look like oracles and geniuses, makes us look prescient.
I think I can't remember exactly what the rules were that we suggested, but I think we suggested kind of variations on these because I find these both very bizarre. And like you were saying about the official charts have said, after a song has been on the chart for a number of weeks, it all seems very non-specific and ill-defined at the moment, like it's going to be a period of working it out to see what the effects of these changes are. They don't seem highly logical to me. Only the three most... I think that there should be a restriction on the amount of tracks from one album that are allowed into the chart at one time. But I think that would be better served by saying to an artist, you have to nominate singles from this album. Not all of these tracks, not every track on the album can go in the singles chart. You just have to nominate a specific amount of them. It's often the case that artists release far more than three singles from one album. Three might be typical, but for example, Katy Perry shares the record with Michael Jackson for the most number one songs from one album. They both have five, her for Teenage Dream and him for Bad. And, you know, throughout my childhood, and I'm sure even, you know, up to the present day, it's normal for people to release like four or five singles before a record comes out. The new Lorde album, I think we got the first single in February, and I think by the time the album came out in June there must have been four or five songs that had come off it. And I mean, we already had questions about the meaning of singles when the Sheeran singularity happened. If all of the tracks from a record go into the chart, how do you then pick a single to promote later down the line? You can put out a video, but as Galway Girl showed, we thought that when they added a video for that, it would go straight to number one, but it didn't at all. It just continued to bottom out of the chart. And if a song that popular isn't affected by the release of an clearly very expensive video, it makes you think, what is the point in making videos after all and pushing singles? And I really hope that it doesn't lead to, I know we disagree on like the importance of videos, but I hope it doesn't lead to fewer videos being made and actual singles being pushed. I don't know, it seems to me a bit like something that's being done with radio pluggers in mind, and also a kind of a pat on the back for the relevance, or the trying to shore up the relevance of the charts.
Yeah, it's a really odd situation, isn't it? Because it feels like an artificial re-swizzling of things in order to make the chart look like a chart, whereas actually part of the fun of the original chart has always been that it reflects what people's listening habits are. And if you've managed to iron out the possibility that everybody in Britain at the same time is suddenly really excited about four songs by the same artist, then that seems an odd way of hammering down on enthusiasm. And there will be situations which are entirely unthinkable now where this rule will appear entirely ludicrous. And the one I thought of was, what if Adele was assassinated?
Heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid. I don't want it to happen. But if she was, people would really, really start listening to her records. Like, lots of different records. Everyone's got their own favourites. So, and would... either the Adele's record label have to nominate which three are going to be the ones that get into the top 100, which isn't what currently the new system would suggest, or would they just pick the top three most popular listened to Adele songs in that situation, or would they lift the rules for specifically just for Adele for that moment so that she could have the entire top 20 of Adele songs if that was what people genuinely were experiencing?
I mean, I suppose it'd be the same as if, you know, any other massive pop star in the past died. Like, I've never looked this up, but for example, I guess when somebody like Freddie Mercury died, surely a single must have been repressed.
A Bohemian Rhapsody was. It went to number one. Yeah, it went in 1991. That happened, and that was a sort of a moment of tribute, and everyone did rally around that. But now that the charts are able to reflect what people are genuinely doing, like they're genuinely listening to, so yes, there's an element of, I want to buy this in memory of Freddie Mercury dying in 1991. That was the only way to do it. Now it's just people wallowing in, you know, I'm sure David Bowie's albums were all hugely listened to when he died, and I think that did have an impact on the chart. But you know, if it was someone shocking and current, that's why I think the assassination story is an interesting case in point. Maybe it's the word assassination that's causing the problem. It seems heartless. Maybe, okay, she dies in a car crash. Whatever happens, Adele becomes unavailable and people are sad about it. Then that won't be reflected in people's listening habits. It won't. The chart will be like, no, well, only three of them. It will be, you know, Make You Feel My Love and Hello and another one, and they'll be in the top three. And then no other Adele songs will be in the top 100 or whatsoever because of rules. And it's just to iron out the possibility of another Ed Sheeran thing happening. And I think the interesting thing that we've learned over the last 16 weeks is, although on week one it looked like the charts were broken, by week two it was obvious that they weren't.
It's interesting that you're saying you know, they're trying to swizzle the rules now. I think the charts has never been really a pure system. It's all about who's got the right TV plugger to get picked for Top of the Pops, whose sales return figures are being diddled by indie record store employees, whose single is discounted and out on multiple formats. But I think never before have the rules felt like such a blatant attempt to ensure the relevance of the single shot at a time when it is absolutely less relevant than ever. It just seems like desperation and panic. And I it seems good in a way that they're trying to tip the balance in favor of immediate popularity. Like, they're trying to wrench it back from endurance more in favor of immediate popularity, which I think is a good thing. But I don't know, I think that they are scrambling it awfully. And the big elephant in the room as well is, when are they going to let YouTube Play start counting towards the charts as well? Which, once they do that, is going to scramble things even further, because, you know, on YouTube we're talking tens of millions of plays every week.
For individual tracks.
For
it's
individual
not people
tracks.
Listening to whole albums at once, although they are, but it's, you know, one YouTube of an entire album, and it shouldn't be. No, I don't think that should be chart eligible, you know, I don't think it could be. Also, one of the most troubling lines of their press release states they're doing this so that the chart, quote, continues to be a showcase for the new hits and talent, which are the lifeblood of UK music. Now, I don't doubt that new hits and talent are the lifeblood of UK music. I just don't think the charts are the showcase for that. I don't think they are a showcase for hits and talent. I think that's part of this veneration of new music, which seems to have picked up as a cultural push in the last 10-15 years. Everybody's acting like they're John Peel. The charts aren't John Peel. They're not supposed to be John Peel. Actually, what the charts are is what happens after music's been showcased. It's a reward for hard work, for a job well done. And it sort of implies that even if the charts are saying, oh no, we're all about new music, is that even the charts aren't particularly happy with what's going on right now. And the charts are supposed to be an absolute measure of exactly what's going on right now. You know, they are the day. They're not tomorrow. They're now.
Yeah, honestly, the only chart that I ever discover anything off, although, you know, obviously, I like, there's a few tracks from week to week on this that I haven't heard before, but is watching Top of the Pops 1984 reruns and discovering people like Thomas Dolby and Howard Jones, who haven't really crossed over to my generation and just seem like perfectly preserved pop artifacts. But yeah, I mean, the idea of the charts as a showcase for new talent, it's overstating the chart's importance in public life. And I know I'm saying that as somebody who makes a podcast about the top 40, but it's not an appointment show for a nation on TV or the radio. And I don't think that this is going to change things. It seems confused about whether it's meant to be a mirror or a catalyst. And yeah, I think it should be probably somewhere in between those two things.
Yeah. I just think it's a benchmark. That's all it is. It's just a line. It says, this is where we are now. That's why, even though the sheer singularity was fun and interesting, I never thought it was like a sign of imminent collapse on behalf of the charts. I think people that thought it was possibly hadn't had a lot to do with the charts for a while, because actually there's always a possibility of something really odd happening. And I don't really know that I want to have that sort of thing ironed out of the charts, because of everything that you said before, because of the fact that it's always been susceptible to these odd wonks, that because everybody knows that the idea of the chart is just literally how many records have been sold. It's not prone to being skewed by tastemakers. It's prone to being skewed by hard businessmen who want to make sure that their records are featured on Top of the Pops. I don't know that I want that element of it to be taken away in the, and certainly not with the agenda of let's keep it changing so that new records get a chance. I don't want them to have a chance unless they can absolutely
fight.
No, completely. I want them to bash everybody out of the way. It's like punk rock coming along and all of the prog rockers saying, well, let's not bother doing prog rock anymore and give these youngsters a chance. It's not how things are done.
And also, I mean, the Sheeran, as time goes on, I think that we're seeing that the Sheeran thing was a complete anomaly that's not going to happen again. Harry Styles didn't manage it. Adele wouldn't do it because she doesn't put her albums on streaming services first week. Who knows what Taylor Swift will be doing with Spotify and Apple Music and everything with her next record. But the amount of artists who are actually capable of this, it is probably just Ed Sheeran. And mercifully, he's probably only going to put an album out once every 3 to 4 years.
And it won't matter anyway, because now we've refigured the chart, so you can't do it.
It's literally one person ruining it for the rest of us. Thanks, Ed.
Just one more tick on Ed's crime sheet.
I mean, I would rather once every 3 or 4 years, it's like, oh, great, yeah, the whole top 20 is Ed Sheeran, just, you know, carry on, it'll all disappear and settle down again, than it happening once and everybody panicking and changing all of the singles rules, you know, changing it for everybody else. When I interviewed one of the guys from the official charts company back in February, I think it was, when the Sheeran thing happened, they said they weren't going to make any rash changes. But, I mean, this one seems incredibly cobbled together.
I just think it's unfinished, isn't it? They need to be really clear about what they mean by this record is past its sell-by date. Because that's the language they were using in their own press release as well. You're just like, well, what do you mean by that? And who are you to judge whether something's past its sell-by date? That is honestly in the gift of the general public, that everybody that's listening to music who are enjoying it. I mean, presumably, what, so Shape of You is starting to fall out of the charts, that means that it has to be given the boot on the way down just to really hasten its demise. But it's the song of the year so far, as far as I can see. Why would you want to do that to Shape of You? Don't you like Ed Sheeran?
Once you've you know, written that death sentence for a song and you've like changed its ratio to 300 streams to one equivalent unit sale or whatever, what if for some reason it starts coming back up the charts? Like, it artificially suppresses things that might have a second life later on. How long does that work for as well? You know, Ed Sheeran's, you know, if we're talking about killing off major pop stars, Shape of You has been very big this year. Eventually it will hit that point and its ratio will diminish. What if, you know, when Ed Sheeran dies, God forbid, in like 50 years or whatever, when does the ratio change? I mean, I think we're being ambitious talking about the charts company existing in 50 years, but you know.
Well, I mean, we've basically killed... I also quite like the fact within this conversation, we've murdered two pop stars.
That's what will clear the playing field.
Let's just kill everyone.
So on to this week's top 10, which is shifting nicely at the moment, I think, percolating, one might say.
That's all this new music that the official charts company are welcoming in, like Your Song by Rita Ora, which is at number 10 and sounds like this.
I don't want to hear sad songs anymore. I only want to hear love songs. I found my heart up in this place tonight. Don't want to sing mad songs anymore. Only want to sing your song, because your song's got me feeling like
now, your eagle-eared listeners will appreciate that that is that's your Trop House again. That's got all of the tropes of Trop House, or Trope House, as perhaps we should start calling it. Do you think Rita Ora's just been waiting for a new pop paradigm to emerge so that she can take advantage of it?
I mean, it's not new. It's not new at this point. If she'd been like waiting for the paradigm, she would have been on this maybe 2 years ago.
Nobody ever claimed that Rita Ora was quick off the mark. Yeah, there's something grimly predictable about her going Trop House for her comeback, as if to prove that she's still down with the pop kids. That said, it is a sound that suits her slightly gruff voice pretty well. And it's a singer's medium anyway, Trop House. It's, you know, it's so minimal as a production that all you've got is the voice to go on. So I find it to be all right. What do you think, Laura?
I quite like the song. As far as all the mediocre Trop House bangers that have been passing in and out of the top 10 go, I think it's got a bit of genuine feeling in it. It doesn't feel like it just popped out of a machine. Like you say, like, it does showcase her vocals quite nicely. The critic in me sees it as like the tragic, safe bet conclusion to a very long-running and ultimately failed attempt to rebrand her or find some kind of unique artistic direction. But when you release a single and it goes in the top 10 within about 3 weeks, why would you bother doing anything? But it's a bona fide success. So, you know, clearly artistry is off the table.
Wow, the critic in you is really bitchy.
Look, I'm very sunburned. It's very late.
At number 9 this week is Power by Little Mix featuring Stormzy.
Who got the power?
I don't know if I should admit this, because I'm sure we've talked about it on the podcast before. It may well have been a song that you read, but I don't recall having heard this. Maybe it's just that I left half my brain at Glastonbury, but it was alarming when I pressed play. I don't think I've heard vocals this histrionic since maybe Christina Aguilera's second album. I realised that Little Mix were a band, but they kind of seem like a one-band Lady Marmalade here, all trying to outdo each other a little bit. And obviously, Fraser, everybody knows that you were a fan of the not very well crafted, oddly sexual pop lyric. And there's one here that I really didn't get. where, you know, I get the general gist of the song. It's about how you might be with, you know, a man who's very powerful and well endowed, as they seem to suggest, but the lady is still in charge. But there's one line where one of them says, "You make it rain." I get that, you know, like money. "But I'll make it shower." What does "make it shower" mean? I tried looking up and I just got a lot of instructions about to how to install a shower in one's own house.
I think it's a lubrication thing. I think it might be about the pneumatic reality of sex there, Laura.
I didn't think, you know, because obviously golden showers, I didn't think they were getting specialists, because Little Mix and Pop Danford, like, tweets. But
I think it... No, I don't know that they've gone into the... I don't think they've quite gone into the BDSM area with that. I think it might just mean generally, you know, I'm really, really enjoying what it is that you're doing.
But that hadn't crossed my mind either, because not to get too, like, physical, but it's not really showering. Maybe people can... Maybe that's one for the Facebook page. Yeah.
Let's debate this somewhere else. Don't you love it when me and Laura talk sex? There is a real will-they-won't-they vibe about this podcast, but clearly the answer is, if they do, they won't know what they're doing.
On to a song that will be quick to extinguish any sexual flame via the awful Victoria's Secret video. Number 8 is "To You" by David Guetta featuring Justin Bieber. "Speak for my heart when it comes to you, comes to you." "Want you to share it."
Number 7 is "I'm the One" by DJ Khaled featuring Justin Bieber, Quavo, Chance the Rapper and Lil Wayne.
At number 6 is "Strip That Down" by Liam Payne featuring, once again, Quavo. "You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down for me, baby. Now there's a lot of people in the crowd, but only you can dance with me. So put your hands on my body and swing that crown for me, baby. You know I love it when the music's loud, but come on, strip that down."
At number 5 is "Mama" by Jonas Blue featuring William Singe. Now, I would like to issue a challenge to all I'm Breaking My Chart listeners. I've just said the name of the song. We haven't played it yet. How does it go? Well, it goes like this. But what I have to admit is that I can't get this song to stick in my head whatsoever. It's been in the top 10 for 8 weeks. We do a podcast about the top 10, so that's 8 times I've had to listen to it. And I still have to go back and listen to it again every time we have to talk about it. It's sort of, to me, it's a hallmark of how generic a sound this song has, which, you know, references back to Rita Ora as well. But, you know, I probably would say that if I couldn't get something to stick in my head. But there's just something non-memorable about it. I'm really sorry.
I managed to get a few seconds of it stuck in my head. I can remember the "Where Do We Run To" part, but then my brain goes straight into the little, like, xylophone motif from Symphony by Clean Bandit and starts playing that instead. Do you ever get those, like, mental mashups where your brain just composites two songs together? There's a lot of Taylor Swift mental mashups on the Lorde album, parts where you're like, oh, it's about to go into this big leaping vocal, but it's like, I know, it's Lorde, it's going to be subtler than that.
Also, "Twinkle Twinkle Little Star" and "Ba Ba Black Sheep," they're the same, essentially the same tune.
At number 4 is "Unforgettable" by French Montana featuring Swae Lee.
And at number 3 is "Bridge Over Troubled Water" by Artist for Grenfell.
"For every lost soul up in Grenfell, even though I've never even met you. Cause that could have been my mum's house. Or that could have been my nephew. Now that could have been me up there, waving my white plain tee up there, with my friends on the ground trying to see up there. I just hope that you rest and you're free up there. I can't feel your pain, but it's still where it is. Went to the block just to chill with the kids. Troubled waters come running past. I'ma be right there just to build when you a bridge, y'all."
Which surprisingly drops to 2 places after only a week. And it maybe reflects how quickly people rush to act in a crisis and then move on if the song doesn't attain a kind of musical life of its own. And certainly, we were talking earlier on about how the song itself, once you get into the kind of the bits where people are just taking their one line and then moving on, and the editing of the voices where, you know, they obviously they've sung all of the song and they've just cut the line that works best for their voice, after a while it just becomes like, even with We Are the World, they were singing harmonies with each other and it felt like there were a lot of people in a room together, and there's something about this that just doesn't feel like that. So I guess musically it's not something that people are choosing to listen to. Stormzy, you know, Stormzy's bit notwithstanding, because that's still great. But the rest of it...
Oh, no, it makes me think, how does the charity single survive in the streaming age? Because this probably went to number one the first week because everybody spent their 79p on it. But then once you bought it once, you're not going to buy it again. And especially with a, you know, if a charity single is good, you might listen to it a few times on Spotify. But also you own it, so maybe you're playing it on iTunes. And also it's, you know, I don't want to diminish the purpose of the song, but it's really horrible. And I can't imagine most people are listening to this on Spotify for fun.
I don't want to diminish the purpose of the song, but it's really horrible.
Well, look, I paid for it. I bought it so that we could put it in last week's chart. And then I deleted it because I never wanted to listen to it again. But I think also, you know, getting slightly outside the remit of pop, do they think people realise with something as thorny and appalling as what happened at the Grenfell Tower, it was great that all these artists rallied together and they released this song to raise awareness of it? But I think it's not like famine in Ethiopia or something. It is a problem that is going to take an incredibly long time to solve, that is mired in appalling levels of bureaucracy that seem like they're being horribly handled at kind of every level of it. And it makes sense for me, I think, this song had a very immediate impact, but then it's going to go away equally quickly because it will not provide any lasting help, if that makes sense.
I'd quite like to go up to every single pop star who contributed to it and ask them what their political view is of austerity, because the events in Grenfell seem to be inextricably linked with austerity politics. So is Rita Ora or, you know, whoever else is singing on this, are they outspoken opponents of the Conservative government of the last few years? Because they've just appeared on a very political single that suggests that they are.
I do think that's interesting, though. One of us should write about that. Like, what is the relevance of the charity single in the streaming age? Because it inevitably means you'll have a 1 week blast and then it will go away again.
The whole thing with Bridge Over Troubled Water in this particular instance is that it's a song that already exists. Whereas Feed the World, they wrote the song. So actually there was an element of people, not only people buying it to support it, but because it was a thing that they wanted to listen to because it was new. It was a thing. And there isn't that. You know, now, and even almost immediately after We Are the World, most charity singles reverted to the idea of nicking a ballad that already existed and taking it a line at a time. But writing new songs for situations is a thing as well. And that might be the solution to the streaming situation, but it's hard to do.
So at number two is Wild Thoughts by DJ Khaled featuring Rihanna and Bryson Tiller. Diamonds and nothing when I'm shining with ya. Just keep it white and black as if I'm your sister. I'm too hip to hop around time I hit with ya. I know I get wild, wild, wild. Wild, wild, wild thoughts. Wild, wild, wild. When I'm with you, all I get is wild thoughts. We've had an email from Sophie Appleby about this. She says, Wild Thoughts is ace, but it's essentially a Rihanna song, isn't it? I could do without the guys occasionally interjecting. Is this a consequence of what Laura termed SEO pop? Fraser, what do you think?
Well, it's a consequence of how the song was made. It's a DJ Khaled production of a Santana sample with a Party Next Door topline melody, which is why it sounds like other Rihanna songs, such as Work, because Party Next Door wrote that for her as well. And just like Work, the bits where Rihanna is not singing are the bits where it starts to sound more ordinary, because there is something in the way that she delivers that kind of melody that makes it compelling. The samba backbeat is kind of supple and bewitching, but it's interesting that it's that Drake-style meandering melody, or at least it's a melody that I always associate with Drake, that seems to grow out of the monotony of one-note minimal productions, and that it became very difficult to find a melody to go with a backing track that is literally one bass note or that lingers on one chord throughout. And so there's this kind of strange melodic thing which pushes towards the bottom of people's vocal ranges and sounds kind of grating and has this weird grain and almost atonal edge to it. And Rihanna is the absolute queen of that. So I think Sophie's right, that this is a song in which Rihanna arrives grasps the song by the scruff of the neck, owns it, and then leaves. And then whatever anybody else does, even though this has more chord changes than your average song of this ilk, and it has Santana playing the guitar, it seems, in the middle of it, it's Rihanna's song completely from top to bottom.
On that note, I will add these to the show notes, but there is a really, really a good article on Pitchfork from a couple of months ago with the title, "Is Rihanna the Most Influential Pop Singer of the Past Decade?" which makes a very good case for the answer being yes. So we'll put a link to that in because it ties in exactly to what you were just saying. Back at number one, to probably nobody's surprise, is Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo.
Now, Laura, I need to tell you that the teenagers in my house, and therefore the teenagers at their school, have changed the lyrics to this. And I'm pretty sure it's not cultural appropriation that they've done it, because they don't sing the words Dorito. They're not trying to be Spanish, but they do sing Jeff Sapido, and he goes swimming in a pair of Speedos. And I kind of love it. It's slightly ruined the song, I have to say. But I defy anybody now to listen to the song and not start thinking of a guy at a swimming pool, Jeff Sapido.
That's great. That's all I'm going to have stuck in my head now. But this reminds me of when... Do you remember Jenny from the Block, the great Jennifer Lopez single?
Yes, I do.
Radio 1, the breakfast show at that time, used to have... I think it was like a regular feature where people could ring in and they could like make up new words to pop singles and the best one got to go on air. And I have never been able to hear that song as anything other... Don't be fooled by the rocks that I've got. I'm still Jenny from the dock. Used to have a dinghy, now I have a yacht. Which, that's lived with me for about 15 years.
But they're absolutely those things. It's like Jesus Christ Superstar went round the corner on a Yamaha, done a skid, killed a kid, took it to the hospital, it cost a quid. These things are always at their best when they mean nothing, absolutely nothing. They're just a pleasing way of putting words into a tune.
When you started singing that, I was thinking, who's Jeff? And then by the end of it, I thought, I don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. If you see him in he's hanging around the swimming pool, he's got a pair of Speedos on, but he's a pedo, so keep, if you're worried, don't take little kids anywhere near him.
Perfect. Well, and this reminds me of the fact that this has gone back to number one and shows no signs of moving. Going back to Wild Thoughts, we seem to be very much on the Despacito train now, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, by the end of the summer we've got Rita Ora desperately trying to do some kind of Latin American steamy thing rather than the outdated Trop House vibe. Which brings us to an email from Lucas Zingali Meira in Brazil, who writes, "Back in episode 6, you met Brazilian singer Anitta, who was charting with two different features in other people's songs. And now I sure hope I beat the other Brazilian who keeps emailing you to it." Hello, Anna.
Hi, Anna.
Because Anitta is headed for international superstardom, and she has three contenders for the Song of the Summer, each in a different language, all in the Spotify's chart top 10, presumably the Brazilian one. And this email is also from a few weeks ago, I should say. Starting at the bottom, as you do, at number 8 is her feature in Iggy Azalea's Switch. It is, of course, a terrible song, and Anitta is barely in it, so there's that. Also, I don't believe any of Iggy's new music has charted in the UK or the US, and this is the only one that's charted over here, which says something about who has the star power. I can't stop thinking this is a desperate attempt for Iggy to salvage her career by clinging to the Brazilian market, and it doesn't seem to be working. I don't think many people will miss her anyway. At least they got Anitta on Jimmy Fallon, I guess. In a huge leap to number 2, Anitta is a guest vocalist in Suara Cara, a track in Major Lazer's new EP. She shares credit with Pablo Vittar, who has surpassed RuPaul and now holds the record for the most YouTube views on a music video for an original song by a drag queen. That is an amazing record. And speaking of YouTube views, Suara Cara has twice as many as No No Better, the actual single from the EP, but less than half of the Spotify listens. Good stats. And at number 1 in Brazil at the time of this email is Anitta's own track, Paradina, in which she sings in Spanish. The most interesting thing about her going reggaeton is that even though she's probably doing that as a way of furthering her own career in Latin America, the effect it's been having here ever since she collaborated with Maluma last year is that Spanish has become a viable language for the radio. We still can't see if this will bear any fruit and bring more Spanish songs that will no doubt get us closer to greater Latin American unity or not, but right now, at least I can say, Paradina is really fun. That is a brilliant email. It makes me want to go away and investigate the Brazilian pop charts. And also, I love the idea that Iggy Azalea is just like, she's trying to find a niche. But even in quite a niche chart, people still don't want her. They just want the featured artist.
Who is better than she is.
Yes, exactly. And I love that we have like a mildly competitive tiny Brazilian listenership. That's amazing. But it does bring us on to something that Anna told us on Twitter a week ago, which is the news that Justin Bieber is now set to collaborate with Anita as well. Though it's unclear yet whether this means a new song or him jumping on a remix of Paradina. So, I mean, as well as the idea that the chart might be full of, like, you know, steamy Latin American songs by the end of the summer, I also feel like it's going to, by the end of the summer, the top 10 is going to vaguely resemble Disney's mildly racist Small World ride. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but you sit in a little boat and you sail around the world and everybody sings the same song in a slightly different regional idiom of music. It will be just like that, but just with Bieber guesting on a track from every country around the world.
And my children changing the lyrics to something offensive.
Can you get them on Paradina early, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're very creative. Okay, well, this week we've only got a couple of new releases that we're going to look at, both by ferocious men. First is Bruce Wayne by Bugsy Malone, which sounds like this. Blacked out down to the feet. Me, I got something new for the street. Supply and demand part three. Yeah, I'm on a different planet. They've seen everything I got and they want it. Man say that they're gonna smack man apart and they see man in the flesh and they don't want it. Why say you wanna go bar for bar? Cause when I heard you bar for bar, you're robotic. This one's like a gangbanger with a blacked out man bag and a flow psychotic. I'm hard like a gym with no tonic. Flying like a tails with no sonic. You don't know the AMG is strict chronic and the kick on it's quick like a... Yeah, Laura, you had theories about why he's riding the Batman wave.
Well, not so much a theory, but just, you know, a silly idea that, like, I think at the moment, like, grime just seems capable of solving many societal ills. I really love the Grime for Corbyn campaign. I love the way that many of the artists talk about depression and representing young black men. One of the top three sets I saw at Glastonbury last week was the Boy Better Know set, which was just amazing. And now if this track is anything to go by, Bugsy Malone is going to start some kind of vigilante crime-fighting outfit to settle all the crimes that the police aren't dealing with, and I'm here for it. I think it's great.
So even though you're correct in what grime seems capable of, I'm not sure that this track is doing that. For someone to be half talking about wearing a ski mask and scaring people and half talking about how brilliant it is to ride around in an expensive car that he basically thinks is the Batmobile is an odd thing.
Much less impressive this week is Chinatown by Liam Gallagher. I have no problem with auto-tune, I love synthesizers, no problem with process pop, but of all the instruments in music that you do not mess with, surely Liam Gallagher's snarling, rasping voice is top of the list. But on this really bad ballad with nonsensical lyrics, he sounds like he's either singing from beyond the grave or giving us some kind of idea of what Jake Bugg, not the world's most gifted vocalist, might sound like in two decades' time. I'm quite on board with the Liam Gallagher comeback, but I think this is tragically poor. What do you think?
No, completely agree. I don't understand anybody that doesn't want to be closer to Liam Gallagher's, the grain of Liam Gallagher's voice, that roar. And actually, what's interesting about Liam Gallagher's voice is that it is attaining more grain as time goes by and less ability to hold melody. So he's becoming more and more... Because he always had that kind of demeanour of a wounded animal anyway. And he sings like a wounded animal. And so to be singing like a wounded animal that's trapped down a well is sort of pathetic. Whereas what you want to have is him singing like the bear that's just reared up in front of your face, even if he's really sad, even if it is a ballad.
Yes, and I'm sure one of our like pop rules that we have bandied about, one day we should do a special episode of all the pop rules, but I think a general pop rule is when your song name checks a number of vastly superior pop songs, you'd better be sure that yours is pretty good as well. And this fails on many counts.
Sorry, Liam. I mean, if you want to come and shout at us about it, that's fine as well, because I think that would be better than this record.
Yes. Fraser, what is your most streamed song this week?
Now, I've got a story this week. I was contacted by somebody I hadn't seen in 30 years, who I used to work in a music shop in Western Supermare selling guitars. And I used to work with a man called Matt, and somebody that was in quite often was a man called Simon. Simon went off and had led an extraordinary life that I knew nothing about until I read his autobiography, which was about the time that he... It sort of loosely hung around the fact that he used to be Oasis's cocaine dealer, but then he descended into his own drug hell, really got very, very close to killing himself on heroin. He's called Simon Mason. The book is called Too High, Too Far, Too Soon. It is grotesquely frank. He's now a drug counsellor, a model of the possibilities of abstinence, and he's the leader of a band that he was never mature enough to lead until now. So he tried to have Britpop bands, because Britpop is his era, but he was too coked up to realise that the bands were always awful and he was the worst thing about them. And this is what he says in the book. We get this band together and nobody wants to work with me because I'm being such an unbearable arse. Now he's formed a band. Now he's clean. You know, he's got his life together. He's formed a band. He's older than I am. And he's making a fist of it. The band, they're called Hightown Pirates. And they make big steroidal indie rock. Their first album came out, I think, last week. And Last Chance Saloon is one of the songs on it. And it sounds like this. I drank the bar dry at the Last Chance Saloon. Spat at the sun. I burned holes in the moon. I kissed the feet of the wicked. I led the faithful to a cross. Crashed a ride, burned my wings, took a fall. Could not care less, and I needed to care more. I choked on my words. I saw a doctor, got diseased. Yes, it's insane, but you know that's the game that I like. I quit as soon as I'm done loving you. So yeah, big steroidal indie rock. It's Doves without the detail. It's Liam Gallagher with flutes. And it's not my usual cup of tea, but it's their first album. And as I said, he's older than I am. And it's Simon's first real chance at doing something with music because he profoundly distracted himself for 30 years with drugs. And there's something remarkable in all that. And I said, when he contacted me, if I could help him to help people to, at least hear his music, then I would. And so here I am, and I am doing that. I genuinely have been listening to it. I recommend the book. I recommend listening to the album. It might not be your cup of tea, but the fact that it exists is remarkable.
Yeah, that book sounds great. My most streamed song of the week, probably surprising nobody, is New York by Saint Vincent. I think it's St. Vincent's fifth album is coming out later this year at some point. Nothing official has been announced yet. This song has kind of just gone out into the world with no details around it. We know that the album has possibly been either totally or in part produced by Jack Antonoff from Bleachers, which depends on how you feel about Jack Antonoff and St. Vincent may raise alarm bells or excitement bells, if there are such a thing. This is certainly a really unexpected comeback song. For anybody who's unfamiliar, St. Vincent's thing is gnarly guitar playing. She is an incredible shredder. She spent much of her tour for her last album, 2014, St. Vincent, soloing on top of this giant pastel pink pyramid that she brought to every show with her. She's like Robert Fripp. She could shred anybody's face off. And so instead of doing more of that kind of thing, she's come back with this very opulent piano ballad about heartbreak, presumably about having broken up with Cara Delevingne, the supermodel. She first performed it while dressed as a purple toilet at a benefit gig last year. And when she did it last year, it was just the verses that seemed to exist. It was, just piano. It was very, very intimate. But now the finished version has the intimate piano verses bit, but then in the chorus it has these like huge soaring orchestral parts that make it feel like something out of like a film about a big city romance. And it's very unexpected, and I know that I like it, but I think it's going to take me some time to work out properly how I feel about it, and especially in the context of the rest of the record, which nobody has heard anything of yet. So yes, I think it is. It's beautiful as a standalone thing and very intriguing in the overarching St. Vincent story.
And just on that note of guitar playing, actually, Vice do a series on YouTube called Guitar Moves. It's an interview, but with guitars. Famous guitar players will show some of their sort of tricks and licks and things like that. There is a St. Vincent episode of that, which is utterly fascinating.
Yeah, she's great.
And she just explains why she plays the guitar the way that she does, how she does it. And if you want to hear people really going into the fine detail of how they approach their instrument, then that way of interviewing is fascinating, and they do a really good job with her, particularly as one of the best episodes of Guitar Moves. I'm slightly addicted to it, but that's definitely one of the best ones.
It is really good. She also designed her own guitar for the Ernie Ball Company, and in a big interview to promote it, she appeared on the cover of one of the big world, like, global guitar magazines, which usually women only appear on the cover of those magazines scantily clad, holding other people's guitars. So brilliantly, she appeared on the cover as herself, holding her own guitar, but she was wearing one of those t-shirts which has got a very skinny naked woman's body on it, or, you know, like underwear kind of clad, sending up the whole charade, which I thought was great.
And didn't she design that guitar so that it would fit the curvature of a woman's body anyway,
so that so that it wouldn't squash a boob? Yeah
Thank you for saying that.
It's got a little boob portal. Quick, let's say goodbye before we get back onto sex.
Never ever going there again. Don't worry. You can come back next week. Thanks for listening, subscribing to Unbreak My Chart. If you've anything you'd like to discuss about chart music, or you just want to email us and tell us never ever to try and discuss the pneumatic reality of sex again, please contact us at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com.
And you can also post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/unbreakmychart. And if you want to listen to any of the songs that we've discussed in this week's podcast, we've put the best ones in our rolling Spotify playlist, which, as ever, is linked in the show notes. I apologise, I don't think that got updated last week, but I'll be sure to put all the songs of the summer in there as well, so it is a bumper length podcast. As ever, we'd love it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for doing that, if you have already.
And you can find us both on Twitter at Laura Snapes and at CSI_popmusic. See you next week.
Bye.